didn't get it. We are going to actually do something different than what I had mentioned last week. I thought this week we would maybe do, I mentioned that there's a couple of mitzvot before we reach Mishpatim. We're still in Parshat Yitro, going to, according to the order of the Sefer Chinuch. There's about two or three mitzvot between the Ten Commandments and Parshat Yitro. One or two of them actually connected to idol worship, so really that's already been dealt with a little bit in the Ten Commandments itself. And we're going to then take a break, and we'll pick up on Parshat Mishpatim in the end of the summer, the very beginning of September. However, two things took place over the last little bit that made me think maybe today I would do something slightly different. If you're keeping track, this is going to be connected a little bit to mitzvah number 236 in the Sefer HaChinuch, which is the mitzvah, or at least according to the Sefer HaChinuch, where he speaks about Lashon Hara, about how it's a mitzvah not to be a gossip, a tale-mongering individual amongst the Jewish people, not to gossip. And we'll probably review this mitzvah again when we get there, you know, in about 3 or 4 years, if we're going according to the order of the Sefer Chinuch. But to at least give you a little bit of a taste of the mitzvah number 236 with the mitzvah of Lashon Hara, and as well as mitzvah number 71, which is the mitzvah of not to curse or not to slander against a king, really against public figures. And the reason why I thought of these two mitzvot to maybe speak a little bit about, at least partly I thought about doing it, is because of, two things. The first thing, something that took place this past week, I don't know if any of you saw, there was a law passed in the Knesset by 39-32 vote to have Jewish law be, he's going to make a mess, we're going to clean it up at the end. To have Jewish law be viewed by the Knesset or by the Supreme Court when deciding certain court cases. Now, there's already a law that exists from 1980 that says that the justices are supposed to look at what Jewish law says. They're not bound by it, but they're supposed to look at what Jewish law has to say about any particular issue. And there's actually there's a division within the Justice Ministry that tries to help the justices along, suggesting what Jewish law might say on certain issues. So another law was just put forth to really strengthen that idea, that really the justices have to look. If there's not a law on the books in Israel on a particular question, they have to look at Jewish law. They're not bound by what Jewish law says, but again, they have to look. The original law was a little bit stronger. The Knesset was going to set up an actual institute that would, in a sense, constantly provide insights into Jewish law to members of Knesset and the Supreme Court. That part was not passed, but the idea that they have to look at Jewish law was passed. And one of the objections to this law, which is really a very powerful law, simply says, we're in a Jewish country, look at Jewish law, the justices are not bound by it, but there are still people who are opposed to it, and the reason why they were opposed is they spoke about that this is, it's going to be a theocracy, that the rabbi is going to take over, and everything along those lines. But that's not really what Jewish law is all about. I think people have a misunderstanding. Let's see how we're going to do here. I think people have a misunderstanding of what Jewish law is, that I think some of those people who are objecting are concerned that we're talking about the rabbis are all going to suddenly get into the pots and pans and worry about kashrut of every single individual. Jewish law, most of Jewish law, is not ritual law. Most of Jewish law, as we know, the majority of mitzvot in the Torah, are ethics. But more than that, if you take the entire corpus of Jewish law, it has to do with contract law. It has to do with purchases, buying and selling, tort law. There's an incredibly deep and broad collection of what Jewish law has to say about all these issues that we always deal with. And perhaps it's the probably oldest, constantly thought about and living law dealing with all these issues. So there's a tremendous amount of wisdom. And it's a shame that people don't realize that Jewish law might have something to say on all these type of issues. And I think, therefore, those who are objecting to it really misunderstood the nature of Jewish law. So one of the reasons I thought to bring what I brought today is to sort of put their mind at ease that they actually may find that they would enjoy learning Jewish law because there's principles in there that maybe they would feel more comfortable with than the laws of, for example, the United States or England, which they would be turning to instead. And the second reason why I mentioned that I wanted to talk about what I'm going to talk about today is I just came back from America recently, and on the plane I saw the movie The Post. Have people seen this movie or heard of the movie The Post?
The Post.
It's a movie about the Washington Post, the newspaper. In the 1970s, they had received some information, as well as the New York Times, about that the United States never thought they could win the Vietnam War. And it's for decades. There was writing on what presidents felt, a lot of classified information about the United States' view of the Vietnam War. And the papers were actually stolen. The newspapers found a way to actually steal the information, and they started publishing it. And the government under Nixon got an injunction against the newspapers and says, you can no longer publish this information. This is private, secret information, and it will risk people's lives. It's national security. You must stop. And the Supreme Court had a decision. And the Supreme Court decided in favor of the newspapers that said the newspapers can continue to publish, and if after it's published we see that there's actually a danger, we will retroactively say they no longer may publish, or they will have penalties against them. But we will not do it proactively. We will not say that you can't publish in the first place. And this is a great victory for the freedom of the press. It was part of a string of victories in America, where the freedom of the press and that the newspapers can really print whatever they need to print against government interference was very significant. The other very significant case was 1964, called New York Times versus Sullivan. Sullivan was I think he's from Alabama. He was an important sort of functionary. And as you know, in the United States in the 60s, there were a lot of civil rights issues. And newspapers started revealing that the governments, the state governments, local governments, were supporting racist policies. And these functionaries says, you're defaming us. You're creating libel. And there was something about $300 million worth of lawsuits against newspapers in the South. And it basically put a chill on the newspapers being able to write things they wanted to write. And so there was another Supreme Court case, and the Supreme Court said that the newspapers have the right to write what they want to do. It's only defamation, it's only libel, if the information they put out there is not true. If the information they put out there was intended to cause harm and the newspapers knew for sure that it wasn't true, meaning if they weren't sure, they were still allowed to put it out there. But if they had the real intention of harming someone and they knew for sure it wasn't true, or they did it recklessly, then they wouldn't be allowed to do so, but otherwise they could. Now, why do I mention all this? Because this is in stark contrast to Israeli law. Israeli law, at least in the 1940s and 1950s, has very restrictive on what newspapers could put out there. Hi, cutie. They're very restrictive what newspapers could put out there. And they were very concerned for defamation, that a newspaper might harm a public figure, right? The reason why I said the mitzvah is perhaps connected to the idea of slandering of a king, that it might harm the reputation of an individual unfairly. And so in Israel, you had to actually be absolutely sure that it was true and that it couldn't cause damage. And so there was a very high standard in order to get defamation. In other words, in America, the burden of proof is on the plaintiff. In Israel, it's the burden of proof is the opposite, on the defendant. You have to prove that what you said was totally true, you had no bad intention, all these other things. And we still have remnants of that today, by the way, of course, in terms of the military censor. Israel censors what journalists can write far more so than, for example, the United States. We're a far more restrictive country when it comes to freedom of the press and things along those lines. Even today, sure, right? All the times you'll say something, we can't put the name because the military censor has held off the name or something along those lines. Israel's much stricter, and some people have argued that it has to do with our respective histories. The United States, when it was founded by people like, for example, James Madison. James Madison was perhaps one of the most suspicious, paranoid individuals there was. When he wrote the Federalist Papers, he spoke about there being a great concern that the government would constantly take away our powers if we didn't stop them. And that's why the United States is founded on all these checks and balances. You know, I should bring him for classes more often, because I never see everyone smiling as much. I think I'm telling great jokes or something like that. Everyone's smiling. They're looking at him. I'll put a picture of him next time here. So, James, the whole concept of checks and balances was because we are in the United States. He particularly was incredibly suspicious of government intervention. And he wanted total freedom for the citizens. The government was only a necessary evil, basically to protect us from outside forces. But internally, people should be able to run their own lives as much as possible. So there was a tremendous freedom of the press. What was Israel's history? Nope. Once he takes that, we're in good shape. I'm sorry? Oh, Cheerios. What was Israel's history in 1948? It was right after the Holocaust. And of course, what did the Nazis use as part of their propaganda? They used the press. In other words, in America, the press was part of the process of fighting against the government intervention, the British and the like. It was part of the revolution. Whereas in Nazi Germany, the press was part of the government. And they used it, of course, to defame the Jewish people, which led to making it much easier to murder Jews. And so Israel, founded on that reality, was much more sensitive to not allow the press to be as damaging as they knew that it could be. And so that's part of the reason why the law developed in that way. And of course, there's another reason as well. And that's what I want to talk about today. The other reason as well why Israeli law started as being very sensitive is because of the laws of Lashon Hara. Ben Gurion had his justice minister introduce the laws of defamation. This guy by the name of Dov Yosef. He's an interesting figure. He was originally from Montreal. He moved to Israel. He was an ambassador and the like. What was interesting about him, he wrote a book about the war of 1948. And in this book in 1948, he said that it was a major mistake that the generals made in terms of losing the old city. He said that the old city could have easily been maintained, and that there was a misallocation of forces sent to different places, and he wrote this scathing book, and in fact, he was attacked terribly in the press for saying this, because of course, he was slaying sacred cows, saying that, you know, the generals had done everything they could, we lost Jerusalem, and the like. And so this minister, Justice Minister Dov Yosef, introduced the laws, and he writes, when he introduced the laws, I think I have it written here for you. Let's see if I have it. Okay, yes, I'm sorry, it's number one, the first source. It's very, very small, I apologize, so I'll read it. This is part of his speech that he gave to the Knesset when he introduced the laws of defamation, which, as I mentioned, are much stricter than what existed in other countries. Ancient Jewish law, too, did not tolerate defamation. In chapter 9, verse 16 of Leviticus, the precept, "Do not go about as a talebearer among your countrymen," is immediately followed. That's the verse, by the way, that's quoted by the Sefer Chinuch in mitzvah number 236, is immediately followed by the precept, "Reprove your kinsmen, you shall," right, tochacha, give tochacha. In fact, we do have the mitzvah of tochacha. The first precept became the foundation in Jewish law for the prohibition of defamation, and the second became the foundation for the freedom of public debate. There is no need in this house to belabor the fact that sharp public debate has freely taken a place amongst the Jewish people since the beginning of Jewish history, right? No one would disagree with that. The Jews know how to have a good argument. And so he said, if we protect the laws of Lashon Hara, you don't need to worry that there's going to be a lack of public debate. It will still be there. The prohibition of defamation has not prevented free debate, inasmuch as freedom of debate does not necessitate freedom to defame. These principles are undisputed. Any disagreement concerns the balance to be struck between the two principles, where to set the boundary between them. In the defamation bill, which I now have the honor to present on behalf of the government, we have attempted to draw this boundary correct. You notice what he is saying is that there is a lot of restrictions that we're going to put on freedom of the press. But even as we put these restrictions on freedom of the press, it doesn't mean that there's not going to be freedom. It just means that you can't defame. And indeed, throughout Jewish law, there are a number of sort of caveats to the laws of Lashon Hara. For example, in the time of the temple, you know, when the Kohanim would go in to do their work, they had to wear this, their clothing had to get checked, right? They were frisked. It was like they went to the airport to go on a plane. They were frisked every time to make sure that they weren't taking out any money from the public the public funds. Similarly, when the Kohen would leave, he actually had to speak. The Mishnah speaks about how he had to be speaking because we are afraid that the Kohen might have money in his mouth. Now, of course, we weren't concerned that these Kohanim were really taking money. The reason for these laws was because there had to be a sense of trust in the public service. The rabbis were very concerned that there would not be concerns of embezzlement or things along those lines. And indeed, there are many laws that make sure that the institutions are always protected in this way. And as a result of that, there are times when you can go to the press. For example, if someone is stealing money in a public institution, but there's ways about which you have to do it. The first way is you have to confront the person privately. If the person's not able to correct or take care of those things, you then bring in a group of researchers, right? You would create a committee to check these things out. All right, now we may get there. There's a famous case from a Rabbi Greenstein not too long ago in America. He was checking the slaughterhouses, and he noticed that the knives were not sharp, and he told this to the shochtim, and they said, we think it's fine. He immediately contacted the Israeli head of the organization, and he said what had happened, and this Israeli head fired all of the shochtim in that particular plant. And he writes afterwards, and he says that if the Israeli had not fired them and they continued to do what they were doing, I absolutely would have gone to the press. I would not have mentioned the name of that city where the Shechita was, because this company owns three or four different other factories, and I don't want it to defame the other factories. But if this was a single place, I absolutely would have named the company, and I would have named this, because that's part of maintaining the integrity of public institutions. You have a right to do so, but you have to do it in a very sensitive, careful way. We even have an instance of Rabbi Akiva, for example. There were certain times when people were sentenced to death that the death sentence had to be done very publicly, because the concern was to create deterrence. And so he has instances where they would send people from town to town saying so-and-so is about to be killed, and they would delay the execution as a result of that. There are times when you can publicly shame an individual. You can publicly shame an individual if they have the definition of Russia, or if it creates a deterrence, or for other reasons as well. But again, they have to be done carefully and with a caveat. I apologize for all this movement. Okay. Let's now, though, look at an interesting case that sort of plays some of these points out. And that's this case of the Arab Archbishop. We haven't yet gotten to the Mafia Don. So the Arab Archbishop, what is the case that I'm referring to? So in 1986, let me give you some. You're cute, but you have some issues, my friend. In 1986, there was a archbishop here in Jerusalem, and he felt there was a power play at hand, that the archbishop in Jordan wanted to take control his position, and he put out an ad and he released a story that this archbishop in Jerusalem supported the Israelis in their conquest and in their maintenance of Judea and Samaria and the West Bank. And they took a picture of him with an Israeli government official and said that he's a friend of the Israelis and he follows Israeli law. That's what the Jordanian person did. And he took an ad out in the Jordanian paper as well as in some Israeli papers as well. This person, the Archbishop of Jerusalem, sued him in Israeli court and said, you've defamed me. And how did you defame him? Well, you defamed him by telling him that he likes the Israelis and he follows the law. So he sues him in an Israeli court. My friend, where are you going? He sues him in an Israeli court. And the Israeli court throws it out. He says there can't be defamation for following the law. And you can't, it's not, even if everything you said is true, it's not defaming someone to say you follow the law or that you're a friend of the Israelis. You're sitting in an Israeli court.
Right.
But he appeals. He appeals to the Israeli Supreme Court. They also throw it out. They say that it's not defamation, the same argument. Justice Alon, who is the religious individual on the Supreme Court, says Jewish law doesn't agree with the majority opinion. He eventually decides the same thing. The court doesn't say that it's defamation, but he actually argues that it can be defamation, even if you're attacking the Jewish people, and he explains a few different reasons why. And that's what I want to sort of look at right now. What is his reasoning and his logic? Okay. Again, I apologize for... My wife is in Haifa, and he's supposed to have childcare today, but it fell through. Okay, so what was the explanation of... there are two principles that basically the majority opinion, not Justice Alon, basically argue of why this individual, there can't be defamation. First is, the way you decide defamation is you look at the reasonable person, and the reasonable person is determined by the average person in the society. Would he view that as defamatory? So they have a case, for example, that they quote in New York. The New York case was as follows. There was a...
Israelis
refer to law? Yeah, no, well, sure, because what happens is, this is part of what the reason why the law is introduced. Israel doesn't have a precedent. We started in 1948. So the first thing we do is we turn to British law that existed during the mandatory point of time, or even Turkish law. And Israelis said, that seems ridiculous. We should be able to look at the best law wherever it appears. So a lot of them look at American law. And that's when, of course, a number of people said, well, isn't that ridiculous that we don't also look at Jewish law that exists for, does have a 2,000-year precedent. So on this particular issue, they looked at a New York law case, which is actually kind of interesting. It took place during the Prohibition years. There was a person who owned the name of the case is called Connolly, who owned a gas station. And a large part of his success, large part of his business, I should say, was people from the mob. And he would actually not only give them gas, but he would actually launder money through his gas station for their behalf. But he had other clients as well. Someone was trying to attack his business, and the way they attacked his business is they said that he was informing to the police about the mob activities of his people who he was really benefiting from tremendously. He sues the person who says this. He says, you've defamed my character. How did you defame my character? All my mob clients are going to think that I'm observing the law, I'm informing to the police, and they'll stop using my services. So the New York Supreme Court said, wait a second, that can't be defamation if it says you're basically observing the law. It can't be defamation. Because who are you being defamed? Amongst a group of mobsters? That doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense at all. Here you go. There's another principle here as well. It's a very old principle called peri delicto, which is a Latin term that basically means when there is a problem of people engaging in illegal behavior, the courts don't dirty their hands. They're not interested. The court can't be used as a mechanism to help people who are involved in crime. So, for example, if I bribe you and then you don't do what I ask you to do, I can't go to the law and says, I paid him money to do something illegal and he didn't do it. Right? The court says, wherever it stands, meaning if you paid the money, we leave the money with the guy who you paid. We're not interested in any of these other things. The court has to be pure. There has to be integrity. The court can't get involved in it as well. So the New York court said, first of all, you're involved in illegal activity with these mobsters. We're not going to get involved in this case for that. And secondly, it can't be defamation, exactly for those reasons I mentioned. Justice Alon attacks both of these principles. And it's somewhat surprising. He uses Jewish law to attack the principles. The first thing he does is he says, the basis of the population that we determine who is the reasonable individual is not the whole general society. It's actually individual communities. Jewish law is, right, we have the concept of the mar da'atra, right? You follow the laws, you know, there's national laws, but you follow also the local community, and the community can have different minhagim, right, and different standards. For example, he says, if I say that you watch TV, right, if you go to the general society or the general world, no one thinks that's defamatory. If we're in a Haredi community, and I say, you watch TV, that is defamatory. So it makes a difference of which community you're talking about. And Justice Sloan actually says, somewhat quite surprisingly, that he would have said that it can be defamation if you tell a group of mobsters, if you are defamed amongst a bunch of mobsters, those are your friends. Even if they're terrible people, they're your friends, and it could be defamation. Okay, it's not a reasonable standard. It's a local individual case. Second thing he attacks is this concept of if you get involved in dirty activities, we're not going to get involved at all. He says the courts do get involved. He gives a case, for example, here in Israel, in which, and this probably, if any of you have been building or done contracting work, you can understand it. A guy goes and he buys a property from a constructor, a builder, and he pays more money than what seems the land to be worth. They write in the contract, this is for down payments on iron and metal and all these other expenses. But what were they really doing? They were trying to lower the price or higher the price, however they wanted to do it, to avoid taxes. He ended up paying, let's say the property, he paid $1 million, the property was really worth $1.5 million. He paid $1 million, and then he paid the rest, the $500,000, in cash. And therefore, the property seems of less value, and therefore he didn't have to pay taxes on it. Yeah. Then it comes out a year later that the land itself was not owned by the guy who sells it. Well, I shouldn't say all of it. Two-thirds of the land was owned by him, but he also, a third of it was owned by the city. So the guy who bought the land now can't build what he wanted to build on the property. So he goes to the court and he says, I want to cancel the contract. I want my money back. And by the way, I didn't just pay $1 million. I paid $1.5 million. I paid $500,000 in cash. And at that point in time, the court says, yeah, but we're not going to get dirty our hands. You engaged in illegal activity. And when you engage in illegal activity, the court washes its hands. It almost exists in almost every country. A court doesn't get involved when you're involved in that. So we'll cancel the contract, but all you're going to get back is the $1 million. The $500,000, we let lay where it is. By the way, the original case, probably the most famous case, do you guys know Morgan Salt? Is that the name of the company, Morgan? Anyway, was a salt company in the United States that sued another salt company. And he said, you're basically, because the second salt company, when it would sell its salt, it made a requirement, a monopoly. You were not allowed to buy from anywhere else, which is illegal in the United States. And they sued one another as a result of this. And basically, again, they said, well, since you were doing something illegal, we're not going to protect whatever patents you have in this regard. So, on that case of the construction case, Justice Sloan says, Jewish law says you do get involved in some instances. What are those instances? So if you actually look at the last source sheet that I have, which I think he's taken from me. He knew which one we're going to like. Okay, here we go. The last source sheet, and you see in Temura, okay? I'll read it in English just for a moment. Said Abaye.
Which
is it, 10? Oh, number eight, I'm sorry. Said Abaye. Any act that the Torah says should not be done, if one does the act, it is effective. Because if you claim that it's not effective, why would the transgressor be punished with lashes? Right? You're engaged in an activity. It's against the law. So the question is, does it go through? Let's say I have a contract. I'll give you an example. The example right below is from the Mishnah Torah, a case of ribit. I make a contract with someone, and in the contract, I'm going to collect interest, which is against the law. So if that were the case, Abaye says, obviously, you still have to pay the interest. Because if it weren't effective, then why are you going to get lashes for it? Right? Meaning if you don't, in the end, charge the interest, so then you haven't done anything, so there shouldn't be lashes. If you get lashes, it must be because the law nevertheless goes through. However, Rava says, no, the sinful act is not at all effective. You don't count it. It's as if it never happened. You can't make a law that has no, you can't engage in activity that is not legal. It's as if nothing has happened whatsoever. Had not happened. The reason the transgressor is punished with lashes is because he transgressed the word of the Torah. Meaning the reason in the case of the interest, even if no interest was ever actually taken, you still are going to punish him because he tried to violate the law. And in trying to violate the law, he violated the words of the Torah.
The intention.
So Tamura basically, in a sense, raises this question. Do we get involved when people involve, I bribe you? Is that going to count? Is it still an effective work action? Or is it ineffective? So the truth is, it depends on what type of activity you're actually engaged in. If you look at the Mishnah Torah right below us, for example, it says, Shtark Shekatupo Ribit. You make a contract, and in the contract there is interest, right? I take 25% interest on a contract, an agreement that I have. So does the court get involved? And now there's a complaint. Someone says, I don't like the contract for whatever reason. It's just like the case we had of the land isn't mine, whatever the case is. It says that you're allowed to take back, right? It is effective to a certain extent. The courts say, the Rambam says, the loan works. The person can take back the money, right? It's not like you just, you might say, I gave a loan of, let's say, $1,000 and I want $1,500 back. You might say, you've lost all the money because you engaged in an illegal activity. That's not what the rabbis say. The Rambam says, no, you can take your $1,000 back, but you can't take any of the interest, right? And if he already took the interest, right, he's already collected it and he's, you know, the contract is now over, he goes and he actually takes, you go and the court gets involved in the case and takes the interest back. In other words, the court does get involved. They do dirty its hands. There are times where the court says, if you've done something wrong, we're going to correct as a matter of equity. We don't want there just to be, you know, rebate out there. Justice Sloan quotes an actually fairly shocking Gemara to make this proof. He says, David HaMelech in the Gemara in Brachot, I didn't put it, bring it down here, I apologize. And if you want to look it up, it's Dalet Aleph, okay? In there, David HaMelech is, we're talking about what makes him as special as a king. And one of the opinions is, unlike all the other kings, they sleep all day, you know, they wake up really late. He was always waking up at Chatzot to sing praises to Hashem. What? David HaMelech. Okay. However, then there's another opinion that's offered. It says, David HaMelech, when people would come and ask for advice or court cases, he himself would sit on the cases, and he would get his hands bloody and dirty and all these different things. By the way, the case that they're referring to is that women would come to him. Women would come to him with questions of nida. But there are also examples where women would come to him with, unfortunately, stillbirths. Women come to him with all these different cases, and he would make halachic decisions of whether or not the child, you know, was born alive, and therefore there's certain halachot, whether or not the woman is permitted to the husband, and all these different things. And it says he gets his hand literally dirty with blood and placenta. The Gemara gives all these examples when he would judge cases. And he says all the other kings, of course, would never do such a thing like that. From that, Justice Alone learns that the Jewish court or the Jewish leaders are meant to dirty themselves. They're not allowed to sort of be above the whole fray. It's not a challenge of their integrity. If that there's something wrong done in a case, he's of course nice, comfortable, right? If there's something wrong done in a case, we have to make sure that there's equity. In this instance, for example, of the person who paid an extra $500,000 for the land that was not his, right? It was owned by the city. So the Justice Sloan says, maybe we should get involved in that. Maybe there's something wrong that the person who sold it to him Even though they're both doing something wrong, the person who sold it to him basically was unjustly enriched, and maybe we should get involved. What's the determining factor if you should get involved or not? Because it's not all cases. So if you look at the next source, the last source, also from the Mishnah Torah, but here from Hilchot Mechira, whoever sells or gives a gift on Shabbat, okay, what's the question? Let's say you have a contract, and you sign the contract on Shabbat. So that's also obviously a violation. You can't sign, let's say you buy a house on Shabbat. Comes Tuesday, you want to cancel it for whatever reason, and you go to the court to help get that canceled. What's going to be your number one argument? I signed it on Shabbat. You can't sign a contract on Shabbat. However, the Rambam says, this is a different case than Ribit. This is a different case. In this instance, even though you're not allowed to do so, if anyone performs such an act of acquisition in due legal form on Shabbat, meaning everything else, the contract is correct, the person actually owned the home that he was selling, the person was, you know, bought it all, everything is proper, the acquisition is valid, and the document confirming the transaction is written and delivered after the Shabbat. In other words, you have to rewrite it so you have as the basis a contract that existed that was not written on Shabbat. However, the contract is actually valid. So what's the difference between the case of Ribit and the case of Shabbat? Can you think about it for a moment?
The transaction is invalid because it's...
No, but he actually says the transaction is valid on Shabbat.
It is valid.
Meaning you did something wrong, yeah. And if there's punishments, for example, violating Shabbat, you would be punished for them.
Yeah.
But in this instance, the contract is actually legal. He would say the Beit Din would get involved in these instances, would dirty their hands, so to speak, because the contract otherwise is appropriate. I'll give you another example. If you remember from our very first class, we spoke about the case of a person who engages in, let's say, an adulterous relationship and has a child. And the question is, did they fulfill the mitzvah of Purur Vu? They fulfilled the mitzvah of having a child, but through a sin. How do we count this? So the Minchas Chinuch gave an explanation as follows. He says, it depends when the sin takes place and when the mitzvah takes place. For him, the mitzvah takes place later. The mitzvah takes place when the child is actually born or when the child is actually raised. The sin is the sin of the adulterous sexual relationship. That, however, no longer is existing at the time of the mitzvah. And so therefore, it's still a mitzvah. Let's make sure that it's not a mitzvah to engage in it, but it counted as a mitzvah if you, in fact, eventually have the child. He says there's two types of activities that sometimes involve sins. For example, if I take a lulav, I steal a lulav, and I steal it on Monday, and it's during, let's say, Sukkot, and on Tuesday I shake the lulav. Have I fulfilled the mitzvah of shaking a lulav? The answer is no, because the lulav is still stolen. Right? I stole it on Monday, it's still stolen on Tuesday, it's still stolen on Wednesday. It never becomes unstolen, right? Because I have to pay in order to make it unstolen. However, on Shabbat, I'm sorry?
It doesn't become yours.
It never becomes yours. It's stolen. So anytime you use it, you're doing a mitzvah, a baba avera, you're doing a mitzvah by way of a sin, because the sin is still attached, and therefore it doesn't count as anything. It's like if I steal money, and then I use that for tzedakah, it doesn't count as tzedakah. Right, because the money was always stolen. However, the Minchas Chinuch gives a different case. He says, what about if you carry on Shabbat a cake? You carry it and there's no Eruv. You now put the cake down, and now after Shabbat, can you eat that cake or not? Not you. Can other people around eat that cake or not? You can. There's nothing attached to that cake. The cake is not now in the midst of being carried on Shabbat. The Isur of carrying it no longer applies on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So the cake is totally kosher. The sin is no longer attached. That's what he says is the idea of the case of the person who has the adulterous relationship and then the child later.
So, benefit.
Right, so I can't benefit, but that, by the way, is not a pure halachic consideration. It's what the rabbis call a kanas, a fine. The rabbis want to discourage you from ever doing this again, so we're going to punish you. We're punishing you by saying you can't ever benefit from the cake. But the cake itself, in principle, everyone can eat it. The cake is kosher.
That's what's built on
Saturday. Right, right. So then if there's cooking, then there's... But again, even then, the question is, The sin is not attached to the item itself. The cake is kosher, but now the rabbis have to create deterrence to make sure people don't cook on Shabbat or carry on Shabbat and all these different things. So they say, you can't eat it, you can do it 4 hours after Shabbat. You know, there's all those different considerations. But the cake itself is fine. Oh, yeah, he's supposed to fall asleep. He's actually scheduled to nap at 10. I kept him up. I figured to 11:30 for sure he'll be out completely.
But all this attention.
Yeah, that's the problem. All the attention, right?
And I always follow the rules.
That's true.
Yeshiva is too interesting.
Yeah, exactly. So that is the question here as well with regards to our case. On Shabbat, when you signed a contract, so the contract itself, buying and selling a home, it's fundamentally okay, right? There's no real flaw in that contract. It's just that you signed it on Shabbat. And once you signed it on Shabbat, we have a problem with that, but the contract itself is still valid enough that if someone did something else, the courts would get involved and they would dirty their hands as a result of it. However, if you sign it on, I'm sorry, if it's a case of rebit, of interest, that you can't repair. In other words, if I sign a contract and I'm in the contract itself, it's something that's totally wrong, so then I can never really correct that. So in that sense, you apply that to some of the other cases we had. In the case of the gas station owner, for example, what Justice Alone says, well, think about it for a moment. Not all his business was with these mafia. He was a legitimate gas station. A certain portion of his business was with the mafia. And so, therefore, we should get involved, right? It's unfair. He says it's not defamation, but he says if he loses his whole business as a result of this, so then it seems to be an unjust enrichment case. He therefore says, with regards to the archbishop as well, he says the archbishop, we look at his community. His community is a group of Palestinians. And you know what? If the Palestinians say that this looks really bad, so it could be defamation. It could be defamation. That's his first consideration. His second consideration. Yeah, he died terribly, right?
Let's go.
See, they know what you want. You want this? No, you just want to sit there. All right. Yeah, I saw that. Okay, so in the case of the archbishop, it could be defamation. Justice Malone accepts that as a possibility. But now we have the other concern of, well, should we get involved? Should the courts even be involved in this case? Because he's basically saying the problem is I've kept the law, right? I support the law, and that's my problem. Maybe the courts, so in those instances, he says, this could be a case of defamation. It could be a case where the courts should get involved, even though it's between two Arabs, right? Two Arabs are bishops. In the end, he says, I agree with... Yeah? He knows the end is coming. Okay. Anyway, we actually hit the conclusion maybe a little earlier than I thought, nevertheless. You want to push it? Yeah. Anyway, I'm basically. I'll open up the questions. That's basically the. You'll see. Okay. All right. You know what? I think. No. He gave us a little bit of time, so I apologize for that. The archbishop is a public figure. That's correct. And there are certain conditions of the public figure issue. So in this particular instance, what Justice Alone says is because he is a public figure, it could be defamation. However, in the same sense, if you think about the rabbis in the Shabbat case,